And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sidney Wildsmith.
Today, as the Democratic primaries end, with the hopes and expectations that there will be change in the future, particularly as it relates to our land, our energy, and our people, we take a special look at a 50-mile-long canyon deep in the recesses of Utah. Nine Mile Canyon, it's called, and the challenges it's facing right now, and what we may be able to do to preserve this historic cultural wonder. As we go in-depth, Nine Mile Canyon. I've been doing the Wild Side News now for over 4 years, trying to cover so many different aspects of nature and the environment. And it's been quite a journey because things have changed dramatically. When I started talking about nature and the environment, people kind of rolled their eyes around and thought I was a little bit wacky to focus on such a thing. And now all of a sudden, nature and the environment is the most important topic in the media almost all the time. In that time, I've covered so many different angles, and one of the saddest stories that is developing, and certainly will relate to today's story, is the way in which our quest for energy is now impacting America and its landscape in ways that we had visions of it, but we never really thought it would happen here in our backyard. And the saddest story is the fact that it's now happening in vast areas of America, from the removal of whole mountaintops in Kentucky and Tennessee to the enormous gas fields that are happening in the Four Corners area. And things are actually not getting any better. They're getting worse because now, as everyone's feeling the pinch, there's going to be a lot of pressure put on to make sure that we do everything we can to extract as much energy from our lands as possible. But boy, is there a price to pay. That's the backdrop for today's story, which is about the advancing exploration into sacred areas of our land on public lands, BLM lands, which so often are where much of our natural resources are extracted from. But today's story really involves something quite a bit deeper than that. And to tell us about this story and have the discussion, I really am glad that we can be talking with Jerry Spangler, who's an archaeologist in Utah. He's with the Colorado Plateau Archaeological Alliance. Jerry, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jerry, let's try to tell this story. You're involved in trying to help preserve the extraordinary cultural legacy of the Colorado Plateau. In general terms, tell us about what your mission is.
Well, the mission of our organization is to advocate on behalf of the resources in terms of the planning that takes place for our public land. There is so much public land in the West. In fact, it's predominantly public land. But decisions are being made related to oil and gas and livestock and transportation, and there's no one really advocating for those the cultural resources, the evidence of thousands of years of human occupation in the arid Southwest. That's what we do.
Well, that particular area I'm very familiar with, having spent time in Utah and New Mexico and Arizona, the Four Corners area, which I consider to be sacred country. I've often felt the areas around Utah, I was an artist in residence at Arches National Monument and Canyonlands, and spending time there, I really felt that the entire area, whole vast areas of that area should be bubble wrapped and protected because it is one of the most extraordinary collections of archaeological and natural wonders in the country.
It is a special place. The arid climate has preserved so much of our past that we're able to enjoy it and observe it and even touch and experience it, where in wetter climates the past tends to erode away. But in the arid West, the fact that we are a desert has helped preserve for future generations.
Well, and that is really a fascinating part of this, because people who travel through that area are able to see such an extraordinary historic legacy that goes back many thousands and thousands of years in many cases, and it's a legacy of a vast culture, which I don't think that story has ever been told effectively in America, the extent to which there was a population almost everywhere in that area. Can you give us a sense of the scope of the civilizations that were there, the cultures, and how extant that was?
The cultures that occupied the Four Corner States, people are familiar with the Anasazi, or the ancient cliff dwellers, Mesa Verde National Park, being the most prominent example of that particular culture. We call them ancestral Puebloans today, in deference to their modern descendants. You have variations of that particular group all across the Four Corner State. You have the Fremont culture. You have the Hohokam, the Mogollon. There are really tremendous, fascinating groups of people who lived in the West for thousands of years. And from about, let's say AD 1 through about AD 1300, there was a massive population explosion. People were breeding like bunnies. They were all over the place, and they occupied areas that we can't really figure out why they would want to live there. There are mesa tops without any water, and they're up there growing corn. The population explosion that occurred primarily between, let's say, AD 900 and 1200. Really stressed the desert environment and the carrying capacity. There were simply too many people living in the desert to be able to support a society that large and that complex. And so it eventually collapsed and retreated to the south, to the Rio Grande Valley and to the Hopi Mesas. But it's a fascinating story of our humanity, on this continent, to see how people adapted to this desert and succeeded so remarkably for so long.
And that legacy is captured now in what we would call historic and cultural remnants, and which really drives us now to the story, because you're really focused right now on a preservation of one of the most extraordinary collections of rock art, perhaps in the world, but certainly in the United States. Why don't you give us a background on Nine Mile Canyon?
Well, Nine Mile Canyon, first of all, Nine Mile Canyon is a whole lot longer than 9 miles. Let's clear that up. It's about 50 miles of, they call it the world's longest art gallery, because there's, for 50 miles, you have continuous rock art images, thousands and thousands and thousands of locations with rock art, tens of thousands of individual images up and down this canyon. We don't know why they concentrated their artistic endeavors so much in this particular canyon, because there's no place like it. There are places around that have a lot of petroglyphs and pictographs, of ancient people, but there is nothing quite like 9 Mile. It is unique on this planet, and we don't understand the motives behind why it was such a canvas for these artists.
And it truly is a canyon.
It is a canyon, very deep canyon, very long canyon. It's a major tributary of the Green River, which is the primary tributary of the Colorado River.
And I think that's an important part of the story here, because it is an isolated, very specific form, a long, long, long canyon with steep rock walls covered with, as you say, tens of thousands of pictographs and petroglyphs. I know that you've been involved archaeologically in investigating the peoples there. Can you have any estimate of how many actual dwellings and or small encampments there may have been?
Well, in terms of the people that were living there, it's easy to get overwhelmed by the rock art, because there's so much rock art, and we sometimes lose perspective that there were families living up and down that canyon as well. And I think to date we have about 100 locations in the canyon where we call them pit houses. The ancients would dig down into the ground and use the thermal qualities of the soil to keep them cool in the summer and warm in the winter. And And there'd be these pit house villages scattered at regular intervals up and down the canyon, almost always associated with big, broad floodplains where they could grow corn. They were farmers, but they probably also did a lot of hunting. It's really a rich hunting area today for elk, and the bighorn sheep are starting to come back, but the rock art images depict the bighorn sheep more than anything. So they probably had a very intimate relationship with the wild animals that that lived in the what we call the Tavaputs Plateau.
Part of the interesting aspect of this, too, that I like to follow is the fact that the pictographs and the petroglyphs are extant throughout so much of that region that there it's obvious that there was a lot of exchange interculturally between different factions and peoples. For example, you see these things through New Mexico, Arizona, all the way up to Utah, and all around. So there obviously was a lot of cultural exchange.
Oh, absolutely. And it's very fascinating. Archaeologists will not go as far as saying that it's ancient writing. But it's very clear to anyone who looks at these images that there are specific symbols, shapes, designs that repeat themselves all throughout the West. The book that I wrote with my wife on Nine Mile Canyon here about 5 years ago, we called it Horned Snakes and Axogrease. Well, the horned snakes refers to this motif of a serpent with horns on it. Well, that motif is found throughout the Southwest. It's not unique to Nine Mile Canyon, but it is a common motif that you can find that in northern Arizona among the Hopi people and also in New Mexico among the Zuni.
I guess the reason I emphasize this is because I, again, feel the story of the people that existed there has never really effectively been told, that there was this massive culture. We kind of look at the monuments, the Chaco Canyons, the Mesa Verdes, and think somehow that that's how it was, but there were people scattered almost everywhere in all the little canyons and valleys and places you just wouldn't imagine, and that's part of the story. And that's coming back to the Nine Mile Canyon. Therefore, this particular region, which is 50 miles of this collection of this art form, is so absolutely unique and represents something extremely powerful and important in terms of that story.
Absolutely. There's no place like it that I'm aware of in the lower 48. There are interesting dense concentrations of rock art, Petroglyph National Monument. There are places in Hawaii that have absolutely amazing petroglyphs, clustered in the lava fields. But there's nothing like a canyon that extends for about 50 miles and it's continuous petroglyphs the whole way down.
One of the challenges of this extraordinary 50-mile-long museum is the fact that it really has not at this time been effectively set aside as an area to be preserved.
No, it hasn't. It's a hodgepodge of private land holdings, federal land management, and a few clusters of state school trust land in there. And everyone has their different objectives, and no one's been able to agree on a common management approach. Some well-meaning BLM managers and citizens got together over 10 years ago and put together a management plan for the cultural resources of Canyon, but it was never adopted by the BLM. They just never had the money to implement interpretive exhibits and kiosks and pullouts for visitors and that kind of thing. And then we lost that opportunity. The industry came in and is now pretty much an industrial zone.
Well, let's talk about that, because here's how I kind of look at this, and that there's a race, and unfortunately the energy industries can win that race because they've got much more capacity to just run in, and they've got money and influence, and that's kind of what's happening here. This area should have been preserved a long time ago. It just somehow wasn't. And so those people like yourself who have been working to get Nine Mile Canyon set aside as on the National Register of Historic Places, you're in that process, but let's now talk about, unfortunately, what is happening as this demand for energy suddenly becomes such a powerful force.
A little bit of historical perspective. They started this whole energy push in 2004, and they We're initially talking about several dozen wells up on top of the plateau, and they would use Nine Mile Canyon as the access corridor to get to those wells. Well, in the intervening 4 years now, they hit some tremendous natural gas reserves up there. And the proposal on the table right now is to have over 800 wells up on the plateau, and about a five or six-fold increase over what the initial plan was. And they are going to run hundreds and hundreds of semi-trucks up and down Nine Mile Canyon every day. Well, Nine Mile Canyon is a narrow canyon. It's got a single road in the bottom of it. The road is right next to the cliff face in most locations, and it's a dirt road. These trucks going back and forth kick up huge plumes of dust that cover the rock art, and in some cases make it so you can no longer see it. And what's more disconcerting to the scientists working in there is that there haven't been any studies done as to what the effect of diesel fumes or leaking oil from vehicles that gets down in the dust and then becomes airborne. And then the most frightening thing of all is what they are using to suppress the dust, which is called magnesium chloride. Well, magnesium chloride is basically salt. And we know what salt does to our roads during the winter. It corrodes them, makes big potholes on them. When the magnesium chloride breaks down and becomes dust, it settles over the rock art. We don't have any studies to show what the impacts of magnesium chloride is on the rock art itself. We have strong suspicions that it's very corrosive. But why is it that the BLM did not require these studies up front before in 2004, before the trucks started rumbling? And those are the questions that we have for the federal managers is, all these issues that are being raised now should have been dealt with 4 years ago.
In reality, what we're looking at is right down to the middle of this 50-mile-long, extraordinary historic museum, now we have trucks, and the story is in the numbers. I believe the estimate is that for the next, once this accident, the field really began to be developed, you would find as many as 400 trucks a day, which if you take that into, let's say, an 8-hour day, ends up being 50 trucks an hour, which is one every minute.
Yep, pretty much.
Down through the middle of this place where I'm sure prior to this, there was absolute silence where you could hear, butterflies flying past your face. Now we're going to have 50 trucks an hour, huge trucks,
Big trucks.
Yeah.
Big ones.
Kicking up the dust, et cetera, et cetera. That's an awesome picture. And as you say, not only that, but as well, the damage from the dust, which is kicked up and therefore starts to collect on these walls. Talk about what's happening right now in terms of what has happened is the fact that there's been kind of a fast tracking now. So wells have begun already. Is that right?
Yes.
And how many are in process right now and where are they located?
The wells are all located up on the canyon rim. They are not in the bottom of Nine Mile Canyon.
Would there be wells in the bottom of the canyon?
The natural gas company that's doing the development owns a large, they bought out a lot of the old ranchers. So they own big chunks of the bottom of the canyon.
Oh my gosh.
So they, in theory, could develop those, their private land in the bottom of the canyon. They have not done that to date, with one notable exception. They built a massive, what they call compressor station, which allows them to basically pump the natural gas through the pipelines to its delivery network.
And that's down in the bottom of the canyon?
That's down in the bottom of the canyon, and it's right next door to the only interpretive site that the BLM has made for visitors. Visitors that go there to this interpretive site have the cacophony of sounds associated with that compressor station, in their eardrums as they're trying to learn a little bit about the Fremont culture. It's a tremendous irony.
One of the stories that I certainly have witnessed any number of times, and the reason I'm so concerned is the fact that I just think this is the typically this is kind of how it happens, is the energy companies get their toe in and kind of saying, look, we'll be careful, this will be okay, we'll try to be as conscious as we can. But you know what, unfortunately that almost never happens, and it just keeps on crescendoing and getting more out of control, and it's just a momentum. You look in the Four Corners areas in New Mexico and areas where you can see the natural gas pipelines from with Google Earth. And you look at it, it's just an absolute spider web of pipelines that connect them. So the fact that you now have a pumping station for natural gas pipelines in the bottom of this, I think, is a telling story about what the real future plans are.
When they first started construction on it in 2004, it was supposed to have been of limited size. They made promises that it would be painted a natural sandstone color to blend in with the topography. The facility became so large and so massive, they gave up trying to paint it. But it's basically a small city of buildings and trucks and noise right in the heart of a place that used to be very quiet.
Let's talk a little bit about the reality, and because the realities keep coming out in the news all the time. And the company that owns the lease is the Bill Barrett Corporation?
That's correct.
Do you care to talk about that?
Bill Barrett Corporation is based out of Denver. They have a very good environmental record in other states, particularly when it comes to wildlife. The Bill Barrett Corporation on the Nine Mile Canyon issue has not been particularly responsive. They had a wonderful opportunity 4 years ago to work with advocates and canyon residents, landowners, you know, in Nine Mile Canyon to build a cooperative, proactive approach to implement the 9 Mile Plan and be seen as a positive player. And the reality is that they've resisted every attempt in the canyon to do something proactive. They do the minimum that the law requires and then move on.
Well, now I'm going to make some associations here based on information that I know, and that is an interesting dynamic of this is the fact that the trucks that apparently are running down through the middle of this canyon are primarily Halliburton Corporation trucks.
They are indeed. Halliburton is one of the largest service companies in the world when it comes to oil and gas.
And we do know that the vice president was the president, I believe, of Halliburton prior to becoming the vice president. We don't have to dance around the topic. It's obvious that Dick Cheney and the Bush administration are very close friends with the oil companies. Look at, after all, where our oil prices are right now. But unfortunately, I'm a little concerned with the fact that there is this policy of just kind of going and taking, changing rules and regulations, finding ways around otherwise strategies to protect our natural systems through environmental impact statements and others. And I think that's what's happening here. That's my impression.
And there's a major problem with that going on right now, and that's something called categorical exclusion.
Okay, talk about that. I'm not familiar with that term.
The Bureau of Land Management out of the Price Field Office, they're not waiting for the environmental impact study to be completed, to be finalized and published in the National Register. They're using a provision of the Energy Policy Act to say that continued development is excluded from review under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. So they're saying they don't need to comply with NEPA. It's a categorical exclusion, and they're proceeding ahead. Does not bode well for any thoughtful review of all the comments, over 50,000 comments submitted to the BLM on the fulfilled development EIS.
So just so that I and others have a clear understanding of this, this means that they can basically buy, what shall I say, administrative fiat.
Yep.
A change in the regulations, a rewrite, which is the policy that seems to be utilized so often, basically just by rewriting the regulations, completely change the protections that it took years and years and years to put into place.
They are categorically excluded from complying. It's a very dangerous precedent.
Yeah. What is the category here that they're using here?
It's called categorical exclusions, or CXs.
And I'm sorry, what would be this category that they're excluding?
Well, it's under the Energy Policy Act, the Bush Energy Bill. Mm-hmm. It says that in certain circumstances, they are exempt from complying with NEPA if they invoke the categorical exclusion, which means they can proceed ahead as if the EIS were already done.
And that's exactly what they're doing.
Exactly what they're doing.
Right. So wells are in place, and it looks...
Wells are in place, but they've issued new categorical exclusions for a whole new field.
Yeah, so which amounts to how many wells?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many wells are under the new round of CXs.
Mm-hmm.
It's several dozen.
Mm-hmm. This would be almost a preliminary for the real event, which will be 800 wells.
Right. It's like getting a jump start on the 800 well.
Yeah. Well, there you go. See, this is unfortunately the way this works. And once in, never out.
Oh, no.
And the damage is being done right now.
Without the studies that the scientists have asked for. They're doing it without, EPA approval on clean air. It's not just archaeology. It's wildlife. It's clean air. It's clean water. They're just moving ahead. It's kind of a sad commentary that the oil and gas development trumps all of the laws that we have in place to protect our environment.
Well, and unfortunately, I'm afraid that that's going to become even more a policy, because I was reading some information by one of the representatives of the Bill Barrett Corporation, and basically it was almost as if he was saying, look, if we don't do this, the nation is in peril.
Yeah, that's the tactic they use, especially in the local communities, to muster support for their cause. It's this gas field is going to save America from its dependence on foreign oil.
Right. This is, without this, we're all going to fail. We're going to go down. I mean, it's a game. It is a game. A lot of people are aware of it. Unfortunately, I don't know exactly how we're going to change this. So let's now move into that tack. What are you hoping to do? How are you beginning to organize to conceivably offer an alternative or slow this down or whatever it is? Where are you guys headed and how are you going to go about that?
Well,
and how can people help?
There's a lot of different groups that are involved that are actively working on this issue. Our organization is at the heart of it. We've been involved in writing a National Register nomination for the entire canyon, which would be the Nine Mile Canyon Archaeological District, which would afford some protective status for the canyon, but it's certainly more of a honorific designation. But it raises the status in the minds of the public that this place is of national significance. So we're working on that. The National Trust for Historic Preservation and wilderness advocates here in Utah and regionally, the Wilderness Society and the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, have been very active on the West Tavaputs full field development issue. And they carry all the water with the legal challenges and all of that. And there are many, many issues that are legally suspect and in some places, blatantly illegal.
What legality could effectively, let's be really honest here. There probably is no way to really stop what's going on right now, is there?
There probably isn't.
Yeah. I hate to say it.
They can open up the process. They can invite preservation advocates to the table to develop alternatives that are less damaging, that could avoid damage. But they've refused to do that to this point. There's a provision of the National Historic Preservation Act which says the federal agencies shall seek out what they call consulting parties, people with an interest in the resources of a particular area where a federal undertaking is happening, like Nine Mile Canyon. Well, in the case of Nine Mile Canyon, myself, the National Trust, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, the Nine Mile Canyon Coalition, which is mostly residents of the canyon, we all petitioned, say we want to be consulting parties. And the BLM says, no, we don't want you at the table. You're just going to slow things down. But the law says they shall seek us out.
I was going to say nothing changes, but actually things have changed. Because there was a time when public input perhaps made a difference. I think it did. I think there was a time when the input by the public was listened to and considered, and really the story that we're unfortunately presenting here is the fact that we're not even allowed to talk anymore. We're not permitted or invited to the table, as you say, therefore our voices aren't even available for comment.
Right.
And that,
they don't want us at the table anymore.
Well, that's wrong. It's just totally wrong. This is our country, and there has to be a sharing of interests here. And all those interests, the interests in terms of historic preservation, in terms of the legacy of American history, the cultural heritage, the value of this as part of a truly world-class wonder, not to mention just the beauty and those people who in the past used to come there and visit and really enjoy things of a spiritual or personal nature, which is so critical for us in the world. It certainly is a major resource. All of those are being trumped. We're going to unfortunately have to face this into the future, and there will have to be some changes, and I'm not exactly sure how that's going to happen yet. Maybe a change in administration certainly could be a first start with that. Is there anything that you can think of that people could do to make a difference?
It sounds like a broken record, but stay involved. Right now, we're in a phase where they're ignoring what we're offering. But the more people stay involved and participating in the public comment, sending their letters in, being thoughtful and about their comments, it helps. It helps establish that there is a community of people that support these values, and that these values are being ignored under current management policy.
Can you give us literally some names and websites and/or legislators or anyone? Let's put it on the table here. Who could people contact?
The BLM website for the Price Field Office has a fair amount of information on it about the EIS. The public comment period has closed on that EIS.
Yes, it has.
But they can read about just exactly what the alternatives are and how they intend to implement those. That's a good place to start. The Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance webpage has really good background information. And CPAA has... we have our public comments, which are about 30 pages of public comment on the EIS, posted on our webpage at cparch.org.
C-P-A-R-C-H?
Yes. And people can contact me directly, too, if they want to get more involved. My contact information is on that website.
We're talking with Jerry Spangler, who's an archaeologist with the Colorado Plateau Archaeological Alliance. I'm going to do what I can. I have a personal mission to try to make something happen here. What occurred to me while we were talking is maybe the best thing to do would be a lot of people to visit this site with their cars and get on the roads there and just slow things down.
Well, that's one of industry's complaints, is that there are too many tourists on the road. So maybe we just do a slowdown.
I encourage listeners to find out what they can. Take a look at these websites. Just Google Nine Mile Canyon. Go to Image on Google and look at some of the rock art. It's extraordinary. We'll do what we can here. Let's go a little bit personal. Jerry, you're an archaeologist working in this area here. You've been doing this probably most all of your life. What is it about this that is very personal? Why do you do this? Why is this important?
I mean, going back to my graduate school days, I did my master's thesis in Lower Nine Mile Canyon. There is a portion in the lower part that's about 10 to 11 miles long that is still roadless, that is still wilderness. And I got to be the first archaeologist to go in and survey that area. And we found entire villages with biotic crust on the soil. People hadn't been there for decades and decades. We found rock art that hadn't been vandalized. It was the most amazing experience of my life, a very transforming experience. And I've always had a fondness for Nine Mile Canyon ever since.
On a personal level, why is it that you find this so important? What you talked about, it was a transformative to you. Where did it touch you? Where did it reach you?
I mean, it's somewhat of a cliche, but I mean, through the past, we see ourselves. We really do. I mean, you look at these people who are able to live in a very harsh desert climate. They learned the hard way that you had to live within the constraints of that environment. There was only so much water. There was only so much arable land. And if you cut down all the trees, your erosion problems are going to accelerate. You're not going to have fuel wood for those really cold winters. And it's going to be a very, very difficult place to live. Well, that's exactly what happened to these people in Nine Mile Canyon about 1150 A.D., 1200 A.D., is they exceeded the carrying capacity of that local environment, and they had to leave. Well, that provides some very interesting comparisons for what we're doing in the American West today. Mm. We're sucking the water dry. We're pumping it up over mountains and into drainages where it wasn't nature's way. They're now talking about building a pipeline for water from Lake Powell all the way to St. George to provide green grass for a community that loves its golf courses. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that we would concentrate hundreds of thousands of people in an area where there's no water for them to drink.
You know, it's happening literally all over the world now, too. The story is repeating itself with too many people overusing the resources in a time when climate is changing. And as you said, those people in that era had to literally leave. And my question is, where do we leave on this earth? Where do we go to? That's a hard-edged question.
There's no place left to go.
Well, we're literally witnessing the consequences of these things all over the planet as the stories of tens and then hundreds and then thousands and hundreds of thousands of people are dramatically impacted. And unfortunately, the story is not going to get any better in the years ahead as far as I can tell. And these are real serious questions that we have to really face on this planet. And it's going to involve, from my perspective, some dramatic changes in how we live and how we utilize this earth and our relationship to it. And I don't have that answer yet, but we're all going to have to figure it out.
Well, I'm sure we've got the brain power we can. It's just going to take responsible stewardship.
And that's, I guess, what we're all working for. Jerry Spangler, give your website so that people can contact you and learn more.
CP Arch, as in Colorado Plateau Archaeological Alliance, cparch.org.
Great. Jerry, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.